that denial was not necessarily a path to humiliation. It meant that maybe, just maybe, by following in his overconfident footsteps, I would find my way back toward a glimmering refuge after all. Chapter 4, Chasing Tail. It is now that the music montage begins. Cue the jaunty sea shanties and roll back the sleeves of David Starr Jordan and place him on the deck of a giant sailboat alongside a dozen men in bowler caps. Arm them with fishing poles, spears, tridents, trawl nets, anything to get fish, fish, more fish out of the water. After leaving Penakis Island, blessed by Agassiz to take the work of collecting seriously, David set his sights on the water. The literature of ichthyology was inexact and incomplete, he writes, with few comparative studies so that the field seemed wide open, as indeed it was. As he jumped from teaching job at schools all over the Midwest, he set himself the goal of discovering every freshwater fish in North America. For help, he recruited an old taxonomy buddy from his Cornell days, Herbert Copeland, a muscly guy with a bushy brown beard. They moved in together to a flop house in Indianapolis, where I picture the bathroom littered with crumpled copies of Systema Naturae, though I've been unable to confirm if they indeed had a bathroom. Plumbing was still spotty in those days, especially in a place as remote as Indiana. They hit the water, the rivers and lakes, reeling in various specimens, some with whiskers and some with fangs, and most smelling like a mix of pond scum and pickle. Slowly, they began publishing taxonomic studies, illuminating new connections between species, eliminating redundancies, such as Ichthyloris punctatus, a species of catfish, which David claims had appeared as a new species 28 times. In time, the government took notice of this mop-topped fish addict out west. They asked David to sign on as a sort of mercenary, deploying him over his summer breaks to annihilate more of the American unknown. To Texas he goes, and to Mississippi, Iowa, Georgia, Tennessee, all in search of new fish species on which to plant the U.S. flag of discovery. In 1880, he was sent as part of the U.S. Census to catalog the fish species that lived along the Pacific coast. He took one of his favorite students with him, a bright boy named Charlie Gilbert, and starting in San Diego, they began marching up the coast in search of the country's aquatic residents. David was dazzled by the oily treasures they pulled from the waves. He writes of the mighty leaping tuna, which reaches a weight of 600 pounds, of the albacore with long ribbon-like pectoral fins, of the California flying fish whose wings vibrated like dragonflies over distances upward of an eighth of a mile. And slowly, day by day, mile by mile, David and Charlie began to catch them. The unknown. Creatures with no names or traces in the scientific record. A small lanternfish with glowing spots which had risen from the deeps in a storm. A tiny rainbow-scaled fish that was found inside the belly of a hake, which was found inside the belly of an albacore. A crimson fish with yellow stripes that they nicknamed the Spanish flag. They were at it for months. They celebrated Christmas in San Diego, the Lunar New Year in Santa Barbara. By March, they were scouring the peninsulas of Monterey. As much as David tried to focus on fish, though, it turned out he had a wandering eye for plants. He couldn't resist pointing out the scientific names of the trees they passed. Cupressus macrocarpa, Pinus radiata. He had also developed a tick of ranking almost every organism they saw. The eulachon, the most delicious of all fishes. The silver maple, a second-rate shade tree, the hagfish, the worst of its class for the way it made its living, leaping onto its prey and slurping its insides out, a slime-covered, quote, pirate with bad habits. Ever the disciple of his prophet, Louis Agassiz, David examined the organisms he was encountering for moral instruction. He had taken Agassiz's foggy idea of degeneration, mashed it up with Darwin's theory of evolution, and ran with it. He saw the slimy hagfish as evidence that bad habits, such as sloth or parasitism, could make a species degenerate, devolve, or, quote, change for the worse. In a scientific paper, David proposed that the sea squirt, a sedentary sac of a filter feeder, had once been a higher fish but had, quote, degraded into its current form due to a combination of, quote, idleness, inactivity, and dependence. He wasn't sure of the exact mechanisms that would cause such a deterioration. But to David, the sea squirt was a clear warning, a cautionary tale in laziness, a literal sad sack. As David and Charlie combed their way up the coast, David studied how the various fishermen caught their prey. the Chinese fishermen in San Diego who used fine nets to dredge up a wriggling cornucopia of creatures, the Portuguese fishermen of Santa Barbara who stood on the rocks and plunged 3-tine spears into the surf, even the gulls and pelicans who dove with an enviable precision. He adopted the methods he could and stole when he could not. He plundered Chinese fish markets for creatures unknown to science. He tore into the bellies of birds and sharks in search of creatures that evaded his hand. On that trip alone, David and Charlie named over 80 new species of fish, 80 new branches on the tree of life unveiled, 80 new species willed into existence by the words rolling off their tongues. Myctophum crenulare, Pseudis ringens, Sebastictis rubrovinctus. 8 months later, David journeyed back to Indiana, this time to Bloomington, where he had finally secured a permanent job as a professor of science at Indiana University. It was also around this time that David accomplished something that had once seemed even harder. He got married. That auburn-haired botanist from Penacase Island, Susan Bowen. He had persuaded her to leave her home in the verdant Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts and join him in Indiana. She moved with some trepidation. Indiana felt like the Wild West. It was undeveloped, far from her family, unruly. But she loved David. She loved the way he loved the world. Shortly after marrying, they had a baby, Edith, and another, Harold, and another, Thora. After only 6 years of teaching at IU, when David was 34 years old, the Board of Trustees asked him to become the president of the institution. He accepted, making him the youngest university president in the entire country. It is right around then that his mustache, 2 virile tusks unfurling beneath his nostrils, grew in. This is just conjecture, of course, but how does a man go so quickly from being unnoticed by the human world, mocked for his pursuits and occasionally even abused, to being exalted by it? I picture a meek and murky man, dusty and pale, sliding by unnoticed, slowly filling up with that light, that air, that radiant matter, whatever it is, of purpose. It makes a difference in a life. His hunt, by the way, though extinguished of its god by Darwin, David considered no less noble. As David saw it, he was still on the hunt for the shape of the ladder that revealed how all creatures and plants were ordered, only now he believed its arrangement had been forged by time, not God. But the secrets it had to tell were no less crucial, no less revealing. By looking very closely at fish anatomy, he told himself, he was discovering our true creation story, what experiments in life it took to make humans. And he was uncovering the clues written in the accidental missteps and successes of other creatures that could potentially help our kind advance even further. It was Agassiz's same mission, but without a creator at the helm. And David was making headway. His burly, bespectacled crew of taxonomists were discovering fish faster than they could name them. They were preserving them in jars of ethanol and stacking them on the shelves inside David's secluded lab on the top floor of the science building. Thousands of mysterious creatures being piled higher and higher, awaiting their sacred naming ceremony. Until late one night in July of 1883, the universe cracked her knuckles, those tiny pockets of ions hiding in the air, and released a lightning bolt that hit a telephone wire and threw sparks into the office below David's lab. A few sheets of paper caught fire, then more sheets, then the walls, until eventually the flames were licking their way toward the shelves holding David's precious jars. Ethanol, though fabulous at stalling the universe's attempts at decay, is friend to fire. The jars would have exploded like tiny bombs. Fish were vaporized, unidentified creatures were incinerated, possibly never to be found again. Every last specimen was destroyed. And that wasn't all. For years, David had been working on a secret document, a treasure map of sorts, revealing never-before-seen branches of the Tree of Life. A huge and chandeliering chart made up of frenetic lines declaring insight, declaring evolutionary connections, completely torched. The reporter charged with assessing the damage could barely contain his grief. The flames of an hour had near undone his life work, he writes in the Bloomington Telephone. But David Starr Jordan refused to be stalled by the catastrophe. He dusted up the ashes and headed right back out to the nation's bodies of water to retrieve what he had lost. He did not linger on how much time he'd wasted. He did not consider the seeming futility of what he was trying to do, to make order in a world ruled by chaos. He claimed to have learned only one lesson from the whole ordeal. What was it? To stay humble, to set more reasonable goals than, say, cataloging every freshwater fish of North America. To publish at once, he writes. Oh, to push harder. He had a similar reaction when tragedy struck his personal life. One November day, just 2 years later, his wife, Susan, came down with a cough. Her auburn hair went damp with the sweat from a fever. Days later, she was dead. Killed, as their daughter Edith explains, by a bout of pneumonia the rural town doctors were unable to cure. Again, David moved quickly. He ordered an extravagant arrangement of white chrysanthemums to drape over Susan's coffin. He delivered an eloquent eulogy in which he reminisced about their shared love of taxonomy, their nighttime walks on the beach at Penakis, where the water shone as bright as stars on account of the minute animal life which it contained. Perhaps he even told himself Susan would have wished it this way, her death an unfortunate casualty on their worthy mission of order. And then, as he had with the fish, he headed right back out to the nation's wilds to retrieve what he had lost. Less than 2 years after Susan's death, he had caught himself a new wife, a college sophomore named Jessie Knight, who was, in many ways, an upgrade for David. Where Susan had bemoaned David's traveling, writing that she was lonely, that she hated how much time he spent away from the family, Jessie simply asked to come with. She was youthful, energetic, with dark eyes that mesmerized David. When he looked into them, black as the obsidian stone, he writes, he searched for a distant figure roaming through her genetic past, a, quote, rover from Spain, a practitioner of sorcery, some Doña Placida. Heredity had become the lens through which he saw the world. It was exactly what he was trying to uncover in his fish, how traits are passed down, how certain physical attributes could reveal clues about evolutionary relationships, and he couldn't seem to shake the impulse when he turned to humans. Once Jessie landed in Bloomington, she sent David's two eldest children away to boarding school, an act that Edith, 10 years old at the time, said forever steeled her against her stepmother. I knew then that I would never call her mother, she writes in a handwritten remembrance toward the end of her life. The baby of the family, Thora, was not to be Jessie's concern. She had passed away of an unnamed illness shortly after her mother's death. With a newly childless home, Jessie was free to join David on his collecting expeditions. In pictures, she sports a bonnet, spectacles, a coy smile. In David's descriptions, she can be found reclining under a tree, reading a book, while David fishes nearby. He confesses in his memoir, I may only hint at what her companionship has meant to me. Of his speedy recoveries from both the lightning and Susan's death, David explains that somewhere along the way, he had developed what he calls a shield of optimism. He guesses that his height may have had something to do with it. Fully grown, he was 6'2", gargantuan in those days when the average height for an American man was about 5'6". Whatever the reason, he said that friends would comment on it, this shield, how he seemed unfazed by setbacks. A colleague of his once quipped that no matter how bad the day, David could always be found humming a tune adown the arcade. I never worry over a mischance once it's passed, David explains, a shrug in his tone. In time, a wealthy California couple heard about David Starr Jordan, this cheerful, swashbuckling giant with hundreds of notches of scientific discovery on his belt. Their names were Leland and Jane Stanford, and one day in 1890, they traveled all the way to Bloomington to ask if he would become the first president of their little academic experiment in the farmlands of Palo Alto. David was intrigued by the offer, the generous salary, the glorious weather, the promise of reuniting with those oily treasures of the Pacific Ocean. His only hesitation was the Stanfords themselves. Leland Stanford was a Republican senator who was widely considered a robber baron. His wife Jane had little formal education and was fond of visiting mediums to try to reach their deceased son. David worried that if he accepted, he would feel like a kept man, a pawn controlled by the whims of two people he considered his moral and intellectual inferiors. But that weather, that salary. In 1891, he was sworn in as the founding president of Stanford University. He had just turned 40 years old. Once David reached Palo Alto, it turned out it was not difficult at all to persuade the Stanfords to let him spend their questionably earned fortune however he pleased. He immediately built a shiny new marine research facility on the tip of the Monterey Peninsula, the Hopkins Seaside Laboratory, modeled after Agassiz's summer camp on Penakis, where direct observation would reign. There were more windows than walls in that thing. The ocean was piped straight into the classroom. He hired a bunch of his friends and former students to stock the Stanford science departments. Charlie Gilbert, that bright boy turned brilliant taxonomist, David appointed him as head of the zoology department. David also shipped out the majority of his new fish collection, jars rattling, fish eyes rolling as the train chugged by snow-capped mountains, and designated one of the most formidable buildings on Stanford's campus to house it when it arrived. A sturdy sandstone behemoth with sweeping archways and a fireproof roof of festive clay tiles. Out front, a marble statue was hoisted over the main entryway. A famous naturalist with bushy mutton chops, a barrel chest, clutching a book in his hand. Can you guess who it was? Louis Agassiz, of course. The statue had actually been the Stanford's idea. They had long admired Agassiz's teaching philosophies, but David was overjoyed. It didn't seem to bother him that by the time the statue was commissioned, Agassiz's image was anything but pure. Not only had Agassiz failed to accept the theory of evolution, the mark of a scientific fool by that point, but his faith in a natural hierarchy had empowered him to advance one of the most hateful and destructive fallacies in scientific history. Till his dying day, Agassiz was one of the country's loudest proponents of the idea of polygenism, the belief that races are different species and that Black people, in particular, were subhuman. He lectured widely and forcefully on the topic. When consulted by the Lincoln administration during the Civil War, for example, he had given his opinion that Blacks, if freed, should be segregated from whites because they would never be able to live peacefully among them. Citing bunk measures and imaginary ranks, Agassiz asserted that Black people were biologically, quote, unfit for civilization. It wasn't their fault, he said, it was simply a matter of science. They were too, quote, childlike and sensuous and playful by nature. Too low on that immutable ladder of life. None of this seemed to worry David, though. He cheered the hoisting of the statue over the entrance to his scientific sanctuary. He said he forgave Agassiz for rejecting Darwin because, as David justified it, Agassiz taught us to think for ourselves. He did not seem concerned that his own mind might have been infected by the idea that certain humans were biologically inferior. David, taking after his brother Rufus, had long identified as an abolitionist. Perhaps he figured that alone would keep him immune. Just a short distance from the science building, David and Jesse moved into a small stone cottage that they took to calling Escondite, Spanish for hiding place. It was nestled inside a dense grove of eucalyptus trees, and there, amidst twinkling mists of pine and mint, they began constructing their own personal Garden of Eden. David planted fig trees and lemon trees, firethorn bushes and cacti, apple trees and poppies and squashes, and a mix of tropical flowers which ultimately grew into a crowded, incongruous, but delightful jungle, containing specimens from nearly every quarter of the globe. He introduced a monkey named Bob, two parrots, one that spoke Spanish, the other Latin, a cluster of mewling kittens, and a jowly Great Dane. He claimed that when conditions were right, when the monkey was calm and handed the reins just so, it would ride the dog around like a horse. In time, David and Jesse moved into a bigger home and added two humans to their psychedelic menagerie, Knight and Barbara. David was enthralled with Barbara. She came out with Jesse's obsidian eyes, and he took to calling her his black-eyed Puritan and asking her in verse form, "Come to me and tell me true whence those black eyes came to you." As she grew up, David was delighted to discover that she shared his passion for taxonomy. They would take long walks around the campus, searching for bugs or birds or flowers to classify. One day, when she was just 7 years old, Barbara pointed to a blackbird and spontaneously classified it as a waxwing. David saw this as proof that there must be a genetic component to taxonomy skills and urged future scientists to study the heredity of the taxonomic mind. Never mind all the taxonomy books on the shelves, the obvious observation that an interest in taxonomy would have been a quick way to her father's heart. In his memoir, David commits the cardinal sin of parenting by deeming Barbara the, quote, sweetest, wisest, comeliest, and most lovable of all his children. Unhindered by financial constraints, at Stanford, David commissioned fish collecting expeditions to the places he had only been able to dream of and map as a boy. To Samoa he went, and to Russia, Cuba, Hawaii, Albania, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Switzerland, Greece, and beyond. Subheadings in his memoir for this era include, "I touch bottom," "I attend a luau," "Japanese humor," "Moonfet," "A rattler overboard," "Back to Pago Pago," "Sharks and sharks," "Cussin' on the upgrades," "The lady repents," and "The squeeze." If you flip to a section titled, "Miss Jessie meets a griffin," You'll discover that on their trip to Samoa, Jesse did not, in fact, encounter the eagle-headed lion of Greek mythology, but a large bat, which David identifies as a flying fox. Photographs from these trips show gaggles of men in bowler caps crowded into rowboats or puffing out their chests in front of beached whales, wrecked ships, alpine cliffs. There are pictures of flying fish, breaching whales, erupting volcanoes. There's a breathless account of Charlie Gilbert getting struck by a falling boulder as they climbed the Matterhorn. Charlie survived, but just barely. He suffered a serious head wound and had to be carried down the mountain by a guide. It is one of the few times David confesses to feeling fright in his entire life. As they explore new waters, David and his men bring back strange fishes by the barrelful. Marbled eels and electric rays and lungfish and tuskfish and lanternfish and seahorses and hammerheads and flounders pickling in ethanol. The men get increasingly creative in their naming. They name ugly fishes after their enemies, pretty fishes after friends. They are not shy to pay homage to their leader. A little flame of a fish plucked from Hawaiian waters gets the name Jordan's Wrasse, Cyrilabrus jordani. There is Jordan's Snapper, Jordan's Grouper, Jordan's Sole, Lutjanus jordani, Micteraprica jordani, Iupsetta jordani. They are nearing 1,000. 1,000 new species that in all the millennia of human history, only David and his men have been able to find. The only mark in David's dream life was turning out to be the woman who was making it all possible, Jane Stanford. Just a year into David's presidency, Leland Stanford had died and left Jane in charge of affairs. And it was turning out that Jane was not such a fan of the swashbuckling giant after all. She expressed concern about the amount of time and money David was devoting to fish. She wanted the university to expand in other directions, such as, say, the scientific study of spiritualism? There were X-rays in the air, X-rays and electrons and radioactivity all being discovered during those final years of the 19th century, and Jane was hopeful that some of these technologies might lead to breakthroughs in contacting the dead. David found the notion absurd. One of his favorite pastimes was debunking mediums. He would attend seances in San Francisco just to figure out how the frauds worked, pointing out their fake beards, their hidden wires, magnets, horns, balloon gas, and other paraphernalia that made the sleight-of-hand performances possible. There was no way he was going to take Jane's request seriously. Instead, he began publishing thinly veiled rebukes of people who believed in such notions. In science, in popular science, he published satires about charlatans who claimed to have discovered, quote, the soul of an atom, or astral doubles. He even came up with a name for the field, psiosophy. The unfortunate fusion of science with philosophy. Instruments of precision, logic, mathematics, the telescope, the microscope, and the scalpel are not needed in psiosophy, he jabbed in a piece published in Science, because life is short and humanity demands quick returns. His bone to pick in the end, however, was not with the hucksters making a buck off easy targets, but with the easy targets themselves. Such loose thinking, such, quote, trying to believe what we know is not true, he wrote, led to a vast amount of suffering in our society. A brain that hopeful, that susceptible to flights of fancy, in other words, could become an instrument of evil. It's unclear if Jane Stanford ever read any of these essays, if they were ever accidentally slid across her desk, or if it simply felt good to let off a little steam. Whatever the case, David likely began to find Jane's silhouette, that black Victorian dress and floral hat sliding across campus, an unwelcome sight. Every time she bumped into him, it seemed, she had a new gripe about his leadership. She raised concerns over David's hiring practice, accused him of nepotism. She called the men in his science departments his pets. But to nurse these criticisms, these insults, these painful yanks on his leash, there was always the relief of fish. That wide and watery world offering infinite comfort. Better comfort, he was sure, than any booze or drug could provide. With each new fish, each new catch, each new name placed on a formerly unknown piece of the universe, came that impossibly intoxicating feeling, that sweet honey on the tongue, that hit of fantasized omnipotence, that lovely sensation of order. What a salve, a name. Chapter 5. Genesis in a jar. There's an idea in philosophy that certain things don't exist until they get a name. Abstract things like justice, nostalgia, infinity, love, or sin. The thinking goes that these concepts do not sit out there on some ethereal plane waiting to be discovered by humans, but instead snap into being when someone invents a name for them. The moment the name is uttered, the concept becomes real in the sense that it can affect reality. We can declare war, truce, bankruptcy, love, innocence, or guilt, and in so doing, change the course of people's lives. The name itself is a thing of great power, then, the vessel that drags the idea from the imaginary to the earthly realm. Before the word, however, the thinking goes, the concept is largely inert. There are plenty of naysayers who roll their eyes and point to math. Do numbers not exist without our names for them? Show me a circle without a pie inside. But plenty of philosophers take it even further. Trenton Merricks, for example, a philosopher at the University of Virginia, is so dubious about the existence of concepts around us that he doesn't even think something as seemingly concrete as a chair exists. He agrees that he is sitting on particles, yes, but do those particles constitute a chair? He doesn't think so. His kids have grown up saddled with this knowledge, that their father does not believe in chairs or gloves or most human-named categories of objects on Earth. On a school field trip to an apple orchard, his daughter stepped up to him and demanded he answer, in front of parents and school kids alike, if he thought the hay cart in which they were all riding existed. He looked around sheepishly, tried to backpedal it, but when she finally pushed him to answer, "True or false, this hay cart exists," he looked down and replied, "False." He said he knows how he sounds. If you were to meet him on an airplane, he wouldn't tell you what he studies. I try to avoid leading with the thing that's easiest to make fun of, but I actually think the view's not crazy, he says. His point is simply that the human mind is not always so good at carving up its world, that the names we place on things often turn out to be wrong. Were slaves subhuman creatures unworthy of freedom? Were witches deserving of the stake? His chair example is intended in the same spirit, a reminder to stay humble, to stay wary of what we believe about even the most basic things in our lives. I think you have to think that, he says, if you want to make progress. I got it. I really sort of got it. It felt important as I sat there with him in his office, which did not necessarily exist. But as I walked back out onto campus, orange leaves twirling down so beautifully before me, the ideas seemed to evaporate in the wind. Of course chairs exist, and trees, and leaves, and love. There are things in this world that are real, that do not need our words to be real. What does a fish care if some taxonomist walking a few feet above him happens to label him a fish? With or without his name, he is still a fish, right? Right? I'll get there. What's for certain is that taxonomists also get a little woo-woo about the whole naming thing. The very first time a species is named, the specimen is placed in a very special jar, where it receives a very special honor. It is marked in the official scientific ledger as the sole maker of the species. In taxonomic lingo, any specimen is called a type, and happily this holy type happens to be called a holotype. And like any sacred relic, these holotypes are stored in safe places, museums or academic institutions all over the world. The very first Lycaeides itys longinus butterfly, for example, is stored in Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. The first starfish of the now extinct Maracaster coronatus species, a mosaicked little pendant of a creature, is kept inside the Museum de Toulouse. They are often kept in private backrooms, but if you ask real nice, with proper reverence for what you seek, you can sometimes be taken to see these things and stand before them breathless, encountering in some real way Genesis in a jar. One important rule about holotypes: if one is ever lost, you cannot simply swap a new specimen into the holy jar. No, that loss is honored, mourned, marked. The species line is forever tarnished, left without its maker. A new specimen will be chosen to serve as the physical representative of the species, but it is demoted to the lowly rank of neotype. Neotype, a specimen later selected to serve as the representative specimen for a species when the original holotype has been lost or destroyed. Even scientists like ritual. There is a clicking in the hallway, of footsteps on linoleum. I am on my way to behold the only fish in the entire sea that David Starr Jordan named after himself. The precious holotype is housed behind guarded gates inside our national collection, the Smithsonian's massive annex specimen library some 20 miles outside the Capitol. The building is cold, climate-controlled, mostly windowless. There is a sharp, ever-present smell of ethanol, pine mixed with scotch tape. The clicking is made up of 6 feet. I am being escorted by 2 government taxonomists with badges strung around their necks. We walk past a room full of ungulates, hooves and antlers sticking out of drawers, past the hall of reptiles, some with tails the length of a carpet, toward the bowely section of the building that houses the fish. We are greeted by a locked door. Covertly, one of the taxonomists punches in a key code and whirls us into a room that looks like a library, only instead of books on the shelves, there are jars. Big jars, little jars, each with at least 1 bloated corpse bobbing in yellowing liquid. A giant eel is accordioned into a glass barrel like a gargantuan piece of ribbon candy. A small jar of minnows looks like a jar of capers. There are fish that look like scorpions, like koosh balls, like old men, like tinfoil origami. So odd to think that this is where we came from. So odd to think, in embryonic form, we are nearly identical. Finally, we arrive at the holotype I have come to see. Specimen number 51444, Agenomalus jordani. It was discovered by David Starr Jordan off the coast of Japan and given its name in 1904. It is a tiny black dragon at the bottom of a mason jar. One of the scientists unscrews the top, sticks a pair of metal tongs down into the jar, clamps hold of the dragon, and lifts it into the air. She holds it there for a moment, its black scales gleaming under the bright lights, the ethanol dripping onto the linoleum tiles, and then she places it into the palm of my bare hand. I didn't imagine I'd be allowed to touch something so holy. The creature itself is sharp. It is covered in spines, spines that could draw blood if you press hard enough, but I resist the urge. I touch the knot of thread that ties its name to the skin, burly, defiant, still there over a century later. I wonder if David's own fingers tied it. The creature's snout is barbed. Its body twirls around itself like a spiral staircase. Its fins look like dragon wings, serrated and sharp. Poacherfish, the family to which the Agenomalus jordani belongs, are known for being extraordinary hunters. They camouflage themselves in seaweed to blend in with the gunky outcroppings where they stalk their prey, little crabs and shrimp. Then they use their massive pectoral fins, those dragon wings, to strike at incredible speeds. The unsuspecting crustaceans rarely know what hit them before it's too late. An eerie quiet falls over me. I wonder why, of all the thousands of fish David encountered, this was the one he chose to name after himself. It's breathtaking, absolutely, but frightening, too, in the way of an M.C. Escher drawing. Something about its form doesn't seem to quite obey the laws of physics, but when you trace your finger along its contours searching for where the breakdown in geometry occurs, you come up empty. Indeed, its genus name, Agelomanus, comes from the Greek for no corners. A, without, and gonius, angle, corner. Taxonomists from long ago had also noticed how its kind seemed to defy the laws of physics. Agelomanus jordani, Jordan of the no corners. Like a Mobius strip, 2 sides but one somehow, the boundary between them an unfindable thing. Why was this the creature David felt reflected him? Was there some sort of confession in the choice? Of some dark side lurking beneath the friendly man so capable of winning hearts, jobs, awards? I didn't know. I knew only that the more fish David brought in, the more brutally the universe seemed to strike back. It wasn't just his wife Susan and his baby Thora that the universe stole as he battled chaos. There was also his good friend, Herbert Copeland, that bearded fisherman whom David recruited to help discover new freshwater fish in North America. One day while out collecting on Indiana's White River, Herbert toppled overboard and froze to death. Thus, out of my life passed my most intimate early friend, and one of the brightest minds with which I was ever associated, writes David. And it didn't stop there. Shortly after Herbert died, one of David's favorite students, Charles McKay, went missing while searching for new fish in Alaska. After that, it was his student Charles H. Bowman who contracted malaria while collecting in the Okefenokee swamp of southern Georgia and died a rapid death. But did these deaths scare Jordan back from the pursuit of order for even a second? Not at all. In his signature way, when chaos struck out, he doubled down, hitting back harder. He began inventing more aggressive techniques for capturing fish, blowing them out of the water with dynamite, hammering them out of the coral, and perhaps most ingenious for the myriads of little fishes that hid inside the tiny cracks in the tide pools, poison. David began sprinkling a few pinches of poison into tide pools and watching as, presto, a cornucopia of dead sculpins and sea stars and gobies came bobbing to the surface. Again, he was discovering new species faster than he could name them. Strange corpses were piling higher and higher inside his sandstone temple of a lab at Stanford. He was beginning to feel a leavening in his chest, a sweetness, that feeling of orderliness, of understanding, of agency regained. And there sat the world, quietly, patiently, the size of the world, ready to prove him wrong. In the year 1900, it would set its sights on Barbara, his favorite child, the lover of taxonomy with black eyes with whom he used to wander the grounds of Escondite, monkey riding the dog by their side, searching for birds and plants to identify, making up stories at peace enough even to debate the existential nature of things. Walking once with her in the garden, he reminisces, I repeated Riley's poem, "The goblins will get you if you don't watch out." But there isn't any such thing as a goblin. There never was and never is going to be such a thing, said she. Maybe, I remarked, reminiscent of philosopher George Berkeley's idealism, there isn't any such a thing as anything. Oh, yes, there is, she answered. There is such a thing as anything. And looking around for an unquestioned reality, added triumphantly, there is such a thing as a squash. One day, while David was off collecting fish in Japan, a 9-year-old Barbara came down with scarlet fever. David rushed home to be by her side, but was informed as he landed at the San Francisco docks that he was too late. David calls it the most cruel personal calamity we have ever experienced, and the most crushing blow that ever befell my wife or me. The brightest light had gone out of our lives. As I write today, after 20 years, the wound seems as deep as yesterday. The only thing that could offer him some meager relief, a feeble sense of purpose, of distraction, his fish. He went back to the water, back to the sea in search of more, more. When people have this feeling of personal inefficiency, compulsive collecting helps them in feeling better. Unfortunately for David, however, chaos was not the only adversary on his back. As David ticked into his late 40s, as his mustache sprouted its first strands of white, Jane Stanford, in her long black dress, continued to nag at David, to question his every move, to yank him away from his fish. Her concerns about his leadership, her charges of nepotism, of extravagant spending, grew to the point where she appointed a spy to keep tabs on him. The spy was a bearded, bald-headed professor in the German department named Julius Goebel. Jane instructed Goebel to take notes on David's activities and report anything concerning back to her. And just a few years after Barbara's death, the spy caught David doing something that didn't look great. It had been Charlie Gilbert's fault. Good old Charlie Gilbert, his student turned traveling companion turned chair of Stanford's zoology department. Charlie, long healed from his head wound, long married, had begun an affair with a young Stanford woman. He and the woman were discovered one day by a librarian, who came to David demanding that Charlie be fired for such impropriety. But David did not want to lose Charlie from his ranks, that brilliant taxonomic mind. So David, thinking on his feet, threatened the librarian with, quote, incarceration in the insane asylum for sexual perversity, often a code for homosexuality, if he breathed a word of it to anyone else. That succeeded in shutting the librarian up. He quit Stanford, left town. But somehow Jane's spy got wind of the whole saga and typed it up in a formal letter to Jane. In it, Goebel accused David of, quote, whitewashing a sex scandal to protect a friend, and he claimed that this was far from a lone incident. According to the spy, David ran the university like a gang, with faculty members afraid of disagreeing with him for fear of risking their heads. Goebel ended his letter with a direct plea to Jane. Conditions like these are, as you said yourself, a disgrace to scholarship, and they must be remedied at once if your plans of a great university are to be carried out at all. Then Jane, this woman David considered his moral and intellectual inferior, who had built her empire on seedy money, who was so susceptible to suggestion she believed that psiosophy could reach her dead son. She dared to write via signed letter to the senior trustee that David's moral shortcomings had been, quote, painfully evident to me for a long time. By the end of 1904, according to scholar Luther Speer, rumors abounded that Mrs. Stanford planned to replace Jordan, which made it fortuitous that one night in early 1905, Jane died unexpectedly while traveling in Hawaii. It appeared the universe had finally cut David a break. After Jane's death, David fired the spy from Stanford. Then, with no one on his back to protest, he planned another extended tour of Europe. He brought Jessie. They meandered through the cathedrals of London, the lavender fields of France, the verdant vistas of the Swiss Alps. In Germany, they hopped aboard a riverboat and took a multi-day trip down the Moselle, intermittently admiring and tasting the spread of aquatic creatures nipping at their wake. In time, they returned home to California, to no daughter but a young son, Eric, conceived a couple of years after Barbara's death. By the fall of 1905, he was 2 years old, and David vowed to keep him safe. He got back to work walking under the statue of his prophet each morning to perform what he saw as missionary work of the highest order. With a scalpel in his hand, he'd remove an unknown specimen from its jar, stare at it under bright lights, prodding its teeth, its fins, its scales, and finally slicing its skin to discover its secrets. He was looking for clues in its bones and organs about which creature begot which, about the direction life flowed, about the experiments it took to make humans, and maybe even the tricks to improve them. How was it exactly that the lanternfish glowed, that the sea star regenerated its limbs, that the flying fish flew? What adaptations could be borrowed to reduce human suffering, to take humanity to new heights? He'd examine each creature's guts, its nerves and ligaments, its air bladders and gallbladders and bones and eyeballs. He'd stare deep into its coiled brain for hours, for weeks, sometimes for years, until he was sure he understood what lay before him. Then, cracking his knuckles perhaps or removing a crick from his neck, he would inhale some of Earth's good air and exhale for the first time ever its name. Agenomalus jordani. And just like that, a new species would wake into being. To plant his flag on the unknown, he would punch the holy name into a tin tag, drop the tin tag into the jar alongside the specimen, and seal the lid. Another corner of the universe captured. He displayed his discoveries like trophies, names facing outward as though to taunt the world, stacking them higher and higher until the amount of chaos he had brought into order towered nearly two stories high. Chapter 6. Smash. And then, at 5:12 a.m. on April 18th, 1906, Earth shrugged. In less than a minute, the mountains had been torn open to a depth of no one knows how many miles and then clapped together again as if nothing had happened. That is David Starr Jordan trying to make geological sense of one of the most traumatic moments of his life, the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. An estimated 7.9 on the Richter scale. In just 47 seconds, huge portions of the city collapsed. In the crumbling and subsequent explosions and fires, over 3,000 people were killed. But David didn't know any of this as he awoke to find his body being tossed about as a, quote, rat might be shaken by a dog. He sprinted for Eric's room, refusing to let him go the way of Barbara, to let the universe get him too. As he raced down the hallway, he called to his grown son, Knight, by then 18 years old, who had been sleeping on the roof that night. An eerie and ominous score rang out from the parlor below, the piano being played by the ceiling falling discordantly on the keys. David found little Eric safe in his bed, took him into his arms, and rushed to the stairway, which, quote, jumped about in the most violent fashion, so that it was by no means easy to go down. Eventually, David, Jessie, and Eric made it outside where an odd calm awaited. The birds, he wrote, had already resumed their singing, and the face of nature, brazen with spring, seemed absolutely to deny the catastrophe. A few moments later, Knight stumbled out to report that the whole university had, quote, gone bum. Clinging to a wobbling balustrade, he'd watched the castles of the sandstone kingdom fall like dominoes. He described the fall of the beautiful church tower with its graceful flying buttresses, the collapse of the memorial arch, the stones of which flew in every direction like water from a fountain, and the crumbling of the great unfinished library and almost completed gymnasium, which, having no adequate support of steel, went down like a house of cards. Realizing that he was not just a man still alive on Earth, but also the ruler of this crumbled kingdom, David hurried as quickly as he could to the campus. It was not even 6 a.m. yet. Students were shaken out of their dorms like ants from a picnic basket, scattered all over the lawn, disoriented and seeking in one another's eyes or shoulders the confirmation of some stability left on Earth. He ran past them, past heaps of fallen buttresses, past the rubble of the welcome arch, past, he would later learn, dead bodies, crushed by fallen metal and stone. He ran past the screams of steam blowing out through uprooted water pipes, past sparking electrical wires straight to his temple of fish. Full of apprehension, he writes, he walked through the door. What words go here? Imagine seeing 30 years of your life undone in one instant. Imagine whatever it is you do all day, whatever it is you care about, whatever you foolishly pick and prod at each day, hoping against all signs that suggest otherwise that it matters. Imagine finding all the progress you have made on that endeavor smashed and eviscerated at your feet. Those words go here. Fish were everywhere. Glass was strewn all over the floor, flounders bashed further flat by fallen stone, eels severed by shelves, blowfish popped by shards of glass. There was a pungent smell of ethanol and corpse. But far worse than any of the carnal damage was the existential. For many of those specimens left intact, hundreds of them, nearly 1,000, their holy name tags had scattered all over the laboratory floor. In those 47 seconds, Genesis had been reversed. His meticulously named fish had become an amorphous unknown again. And if that weren't enough, when David stumbled back outside to seek guidance from his prophet, he saw it. The quake had thrown the statue of Louis Agassiz headfirst into the concrete. A ludicrous sight, a punchline, his feet pointing to the sky, his little marble hand still clutching its scientific book. This text he believed could chart the course to order, having led him finally to its inevitable end, his head buried in the, for what is concrete but water mixed with, sand. If I were the director of this particular play, I'd tell the set designers to dial it back a notch, but there you go. This is what the universe gave us. To me, there is no clearer message. Chaos reigns. It is now that I would have given up. My prophet desecrated, my dream shattered, decades of persistence proved futile. I would have headed for the basement to give in, at long last, to the great temptation. So what does David do? What does our careful man of science who wants above all else to see the world for what it is do? Does he hear what seems to be the obvious message of the earthquake, that entropy is the way of the world and no human can ever stop it? Nope. This is when the bastard, the wonderful bastard, takes out his sewing needle and plunges it straight into our ruler's throat. Where did the idea come from? The idea to stitch a name directly to flesh? Did it rise from somewhere deep within David? The needle surfacing from his boyhood memories of sewing rags into rugs? Did someone else suggest it? A colleague? A student? His wife? I don't know. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to find the genesis story of the stitching technique. He was likely not even the first taxonomist to think of sewing a label directly to a specimen. All we know is that he was the one who oversaw the procedural change in his own collection, and that his desperation to restore order to his fish is evident in the paper trail of requests he issues for help. He asks for the services of a carpenter to put small slats along the front of the shelves containing bottles of specimens, for alcohol to preserve the fish specimens, for a steel wall and floor braces. The responses came back too slowly, though. The alcohol failed to arrive. The fish were lying there, vulnerable to the elements, beginning to desiccate and decay. So David turned to his men, his disciples on the mission of order, and unable to think of anything else, commanded they arm themselves with hoses. Quote, The wreckage lay on the floor, kept wet with water from hoses manned day and night by Professors Snyder and Starks. Comes one of the most beautiful images I have ever encountered from one of the least likely sources. A catalog of the type specimens of recent fishes in the Natural History Museum of Stanford University by Jay Bolka, the Stanford Ichthyological Bulletin, Volume 5. Hoses manned day and night, day and night. The sun rose and fell, and two of David's colleagues stood in galoshes, hoses aimed at a pile of flesh. Is this perhaps a glimpse of the true bones of persistence? Cold and uncertainty splashing in their faces, their prophet upturned outside their window, dust looming in the air. Not sure how they'd ever put the mess back together, but at least for now, keeping things wet. David ran around attending to worried parents, traumatized students, university accountants with their pencils aghast, all the while sending frantic messages to far-flung colleagues to send ethanol. Day and night. He allowed the students to sleep outside on the lawn, as many of them were now terrified of ceilings, of shelter. Day and night, friends and colleagues were lowered into the earth, dust to dust. The dust settling, as though in a temporary truce, then rising, swirling, and rushing David's laboratory windows, bearing mites and putrescine and bacteria, threatening to begin its irreversible process of decay. The men watered and watered and watered. Maybe such unruly persistence is beautiful. Maybe it is not mad, after all. Maybe it is the quiet work of believing in good, of believing in a warmth which you know does not exist in the stars to exist in the hearts of fellow humans. Maybe it is something like trust. In this cold, splashing light, a faucet knob turned to the left for over 48 hours. It looks almost dignified. At last, a shipment of ethanol arrived. David hurried to the lab to help his men begin sorting the flesh at their feet. Was that fin? Did they know it from somewhere? Were those yellow-rimmed eyes, could they place them? This was existential triage. There were species lying on that floor that had not yet been named. If the taxonomists couldn't locate them, there were species that would cease to exist. David picked up a sloppy brown fish, the width of his palm, with red spots down its back and a bifurcated tail. He stared into one of its marble black eyes, ransacking the labyrinth of his memory, his many trips all over the globe. Can I place you, he wondered, in a net or on a spear? Can I remember where it was you slowly flopped to death as you became mine? He paused, he squinted, and then he had to let go, flinging the creature away into the toilet, a trash can, I know not the precise rim of that black hole. It happened once. Then again, 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000 fishes gone, 1,000 tiny failures of memory. Did his frustration cause the innovation? I don't know. So I'm left to imagine that very first stab of the needle. At last, he recognizes a fish, an anchovy-looking thing that looks to me like every fish in every stream. In one hand, he holds the minuscule creature like a jeweler inspecting a diamond. In the other hand, he holds the needle, ready to strike. What was it that David recognized? The faint tiger striping down its back, the silver rings around its eyes, the tiny pair of pelvic fins like a translucent butterfly upon its belly? Did he recall those cellophane wings paddling furiously through the water as they tried to evade his net, flapping, flying through the mangrove roots, over rippled sand, through that warm aquamarine water of, oh, where was it? Panama. Yes, that was it. He was sure he had in his hand the one, the only, the holotype of the Panama goby, Evermania panamensis. According to the collection records, this was one of the holotypes flung from its jar in the quake, nearly lost to science but later retrieved. Well, it would never get away from him again. David would have laced the needle with thread, then plunged the tip through the flesh at the goby's throat and out the other side. He would have tied a new name tag directly to the flesh itself, and boom, the creature would have popped back into existence. Evermania panamensis, that one tiny tendril of chaos recaptured thanks to David's unflappable persistence and brought back in to order. So what was he whispering to himself? As he swept up the shards of his life's work, as he threw away the fishes he could not recognize, as he tucked his little son Eric into bed the next night, knowing that lightning and bacteria and tectonic shifts lay in wait, abundantly, eternally. What exactly was he saying to spur himself on, to avoid being crushed under the futility of it all? I was growing increasingly desperate to know. It had been 3 years since the curly-haired man had left me, and the world continued to whirl with silence. I'd seen him at a wedding. We had hugged, his cinnamon showering down on me. That was it, but I kept hoping that someday all could be mended, that our love was strong enough to withstand my betrayal, to withstand years of distance of no longer knowing one another. It felt good to have faith in something, faith that there are entities that transcended words, actions, even if that faith was moth-eaten with doubt. In the intervening years, I had left New York, left my job as a radio reporter. I'd moved to Virginia to seek refuge in a fiction writing program, where I kept imagining my way into the same predicament. I wrote about a narcissistic horseshoe crab that didn't realize why his lover left him. I wrote about a Jill who lost her Jack. I wrote about a woman who strikes up a tremendous friendship with a wall. When I'd come home to Massachusetts for the holidays, my sisters would each touch my shoulder in their different ways and tell me it was time to move on. My middle sister clutched my shoulder hard, wanting me to buck up, to remember my strength. My oldest sister touched it gently, running her fingers along it as though touching velvet, not wanting, I think, to inflict any more pain. 1 year I skipped Christmas altogether. I didn't want to have to face the curly-topped hole of him at our holiday table. Didn't want to have to face my sister's pupils, which were dilating with concern. I stayed in Virginia and tried to hike up to my favorite mountain peak, only to find the road closed because of snow. I sat by the blue metal gate and looked for a sunset and found only fog. My apartment in Charlottesville swelled with coffee cups. Each one started out warm and brimming with hope, a hope that I could find the words for a story, a love letter, a mantra that would lead me out of the mess. But by the end of each day, the coffee cup would be heavy with cold, grainy soot, so heavy I couldn't lift it. The mugs began accumulating on my windowsills. By the time I finished my thesis, my apartment, a yellow-walled attic, had taken on the sunken smell of soil. I moved to Chicago. My friend Heather said I could stay in her spare room for a few weeks while I figured out what was next. It was incredibly kind of her. I liked Chicago, the cold of it, the anonymity of it. I could be anyone. I put on Converse sneakers and walked along the gritty sidewalks, which seemed to contain just a dash of carbonation. I bounced. I felt like I could become the person I wanted to be. Not a cheater, not a depressive, not a recipient of cosmic justice, but a person with a happy home at home. But on nights when Heather was gone with her boyfriend across town, when the city light poured in purple through the window, I'd realize I couldn't ignore the reality of it all, the emptiness of my life, an emptiness that was only growing wider and colder as I warmed by the light of my hope. And so I was desperate. Simply put, I was desperate to come up with some way of continuing forward on what looked like a doomed mission. The precise line in David Starr Jordan's scripture that justified forward momentum on the bleakest of days. Chapter 7. The Indestructible. Luckily for me, there was plenty of source material to explore. In addition to David's memoir, there were countless documents, children's stories, philosophical essays, poems, satires, journals, fish collecting guides, books on humor, on temperance, on diplomacy, syllabi, editorials, and on. More than 50 books all told, and hundreds of other texts. I started with his children's stories, the place we so often lay bare our moral instruction. There was one called The Eagle and the Blue-Tailed Skink. Don't think skunk, it's a lizard. In which an eagle swoops down and nips off the tail of a blue-tailed skink. The wounded skink, in vengeance, scurries up to the eagle's nest and devours a bunch of her eggs, thinking, there's just enough meat in these eggs to make me a new tail. And on they go. The eagle swooping down to bite off a new tail. The lizard scurrying up to gobble more eggs, on and on, neither opponent ever truly vanquished, for there was always, as David writes, meat enough.